This tape two of the tapes describing my experience working for the Bush administration as working as Assistant Secretary, FHA Commissioner for Jack Kemp. The scandal. We had known when I arrived at HUD, it was clear from meeting with Jack's staff before I was hired, and then when I got there, that they were extremely concerned about corruption at the agency before I got there. How much of the corruption was simply incompetence and lack of internal controls, and then how much was corruption, and how much was simply politics about trying to have scandals is open for debate. Clearly, the Reagan administration had been had not managed the money properly, but then I don't know any administration in HUD that I was familiar with that has managed the money properly, except for Cisneros. Look what happened to him and the people who helped him to do it. But clearly, when we got there, there had been very little pretense of things being run right, and the Inspector General had been documenting and waiting for this and then dropped it on Kemp's lap desk with lots of audits and all sorts of other stuff, looking to play for headlines. When I got there, every day was a new press, a new headline, a new something related to HUD, and since the vast majority of the money and power was in my area, that meant that there was tremendous pressure on me and my deputies to understand what was going on and to communicate with the secretary and his staff and to implement reforms. I could go on and on and on about the scandal. But when I first got there, the first thing I did was I finally decided to go figure out what was going on. We had, between the General Accounting Office, the Inspector General's Office, independent auditors, OMB, congressional auditors, we had more auditors auditing than we had people doing, which was part of the problem. But if you read all of their reports, you could never get a clear sense of what was really going on. It was almost like you had 7,000 people working for the Federal Housing Administration, that many, including the press and whatever auditing it, and everybody auditing it was a left brain guy, and so there was no clear understanding of what the FHA was. That was in compliance with the laws and regulations and the mission dictated by Congress. So I proceeded to have my team do a couple things. One was what we called the comic book, which was about 100 pages of graphs that organized pictures of how the money worked at FHA so that you could see, you know, we were a $320 billion portfolio, we originated $50 billion a year, this much was single family, this much was multifamily, here's what it was in terms of a percentage share in the market, by type of mortgage, by place, by types of people, yada, 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 yada. So one of the things I'll never forget, when I first met with the staff, I asked for the budget so I could see how all the money works. And I said, I read the whole thing, and I said, well, how much money are we making or losing a year? And they said, we don't know. That's not in the budget. Now, obviously, what I came to understand was you can use credit to give away and lose a lot more money and make the home builders and the realtors real happy if you don't bother to put that kind of actuarial internal control in place in the budget. So the budget was a pretty irrelevant document for purposes of not only understanding how the money worked, but managing how the money worked. For example, we were losing approximately $11 million a day in the single family, and you couldn't even tell that from the budget. It was pretty frightening. And I said to the guy who had the controller function, what we need here is independent annual audit of financial statements. And he said, oh, well, we could never do that because, one, we couldn't afford it because it costs us about $500,000 a year. And that's too expensive. Again, we're putting out $50 billion and managing a portfolio of $320 billion. The second thing is, but we don't need to be audited because we were audited a couple years ago. So there was no concept of what sort of, there was, it was like flying in a plane blind. No radar, no sonar, no light, nothing. Pretty frightening. Anyway, so first I did the comic book to get a handle on how all the money worked, and then I did something called Spick and Span, which broke the organization down and went office by office and said, okay, what is this office supposed to be doing, and what's not only wrong with that office, but then, you know, what's caused the problems and how do you fix them. And what we realized, it was pretty simple. The FHA had had 8 different commissioners or acting commissioners in 8 years. All of them were political appointees. The leadership that worked for them worked in very insecure, high turnover situations. And you simply had an organization that was not managed according to the principles of performance, and was subject to very high turnover and volatile interaction with politics. The essence of the problem was that the FHA was required by law to be run on the single family on an actuarially sound basis. And all the programs were required by law, and law as shored up by the law I had legislated while I was there, to be run on an actuarially clear basis. And the problem with that is that the myth legally was the organization was run for the taxpayers. But the reality was the organization was run as a patronage operation to serve certain kinds of constituents and the politicians who satisfied those constituents. And the schizophrenia of that was eating the politicians alive and eating the organization alive. For example, one of the things I discovered pretty quickly was that gridlock was not a reflection of an inefficient bureaucracy. Gridlock was a plan. And I'll give you an example. There are 3 ways that you can allocate $4 billion of multifamily insurance a year. One is to price it at the market. So you have $4 billion of demand for $4 billion of product, because at that price, supply and demand equate. When you lower the price to a subsidized rate that is below market, you get $25 billion of demand for $4 billion of product. The second way, if you don't equate supply and demand through price, you can equate supply and demand through policy criteria. So you can say, we have $25 billion demand, and we're going to give first choice to blue dots, second choice to red dots, yada, 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 yada. And you write it all up, and you put it out to your field offices, and they proceed to simply follow those rules. The problem with that is that you then have to be very honest and very clear about what your policy goals are, at which point all the people who don't get the $4 billion come in and whine and complain and threaten you and do all sorts of other things. So there's a third way, and that third way is you are horribly unclear about who's first, who's second, who's third. You let everything gridlock in the offices, and then you let politics selectively move who makes it through and who doesn't, or certain kinds of people who learn how to work the system. And so by having gridlock and a lack of clarity, that's how you can proceed to implement policy goals that you couldn't possibly admit to clearly in writing. The Kemp people didn't understand that when they got there, and it was became more and more painful for them to try and say to the press, here's what we're going to do, and then face the fact that they intended to do the opposite for politics, that they were going to tell the press taxpayers and then proceed to do what they were going to do for politics. What was amazing was the extent to which the organization was run by the home builders and Congress. Literally, congressmen's offices reserved the right to call up the multifamily insurance office and tell them what they were and were not going to do. And they, the multifamily staff truly thought that they had to do it that way. What was strange, pretty early on in the scandal, my focus was on figuring out how the money worked, figuring out what went wrong, and then figuring out what the secretary wanted to be done, and then implementing it. And it was hard to do that because the secretary would tell the press that we wanted it and we were going to do this thing, and then he would hate the ramifications of doing that which he ordered, or he would want the opposite done but not want to admit it to me. And so I was constantly in a situation where he would order us to do red, then punish us for doing red, then proceed to order my deputies that he really wanted blue but not to tell me, in an environment where it all had to come back around. And so if you've heard me tell the story of the $1, $2 disconnect, it was exactly that. I was required to run the operation in accordance with certain financial laws and internal controls and algebraic principles. And he wanted to say that we were doing things according to taxpayers' purposes, but be able to do the opposite and not have that conflict. And of course, the world doesn't work that way. All the boxes come together into one system whole because they all come together in the money. Another thing that happened when I did Spick and Span is I did something, we called it greenlining, but essentially I went through every operation to determine what by law, by regulation, and administrative policy was that division or branch supposed to be doing, how many hours would that take, and then how many hours of capacity that did they have. And what we discovered, of course, was that we were required by law, by regulation, and administrative policy to do 10,000 hours of stuff, and we only had 2,000 hours of staff time. But in terms of organizational balance, the bigger problem was you couldn't fire the difficult guys, you couldn't re-engineer or delete ridiculous functions, or you didn't have the expertise you needed to re-engineer it so you could do that thing in far fewer hours. It's what I used to call trying to run an airport with 6,000 maintenance men and no pilots. But there was a real imbalance because, for example, just responding to audits and investigations and related requests related to audits, investigations, and the press they're on could eat up 100% of the time of certain divisions and branches. So they couldn't do their real work. They just had to sit around all day and respond to audits of people auditing how they were doing what they're doing. So they couldn't do what they were supposed to be doing. it was ridiculous. And of course, the more problems there were, the more, you know, the response was always to add more auditors and more response to auditors. So you basically had, if you've ever read Edward Deming, you had you had sort of a negative feedback loop where everybody responded to symptoms, never looked at the thing whole, and their response to symptoms was to do more top-down enforcement control auditing kinds of things that would do nothing fundamentally but weaken the line and put more burden on the line. So you were forcing an implosion of your line management talent and operation. And there was a lot of ambivalence with the organization about wanting to build a strong line operation that could attend to these things you said you wanted attended to, but then if you built a strong line operation, then it wouldn't proceed to do the criminal, illegal, and other sort of politically corrupt things that you wanted the line to do. So there was a, you know, operationally there was a built-in ambivalence around the money. A perfect example of that was the what happened early on with Mod Rehab. One of the early scandals was that Mod Rehab money had been allocated without a really true competitive process in the early years of, or in the Reagan years. And Kemp and the press made a big deal about this was all dirty. Now, most of it was just simply in violation of the regs or of good ethical process. And the reason it had given as much offense as it has is Mod Rehab grants had been combined with tax credits in a way that caused developers to get truly windfall profits before the markets really started to get competitive around the tax credits. Anyway, during the process, Keating and who was the general counsel, and Delabovi were both pretty aggressive about blaming the career staff in the Section 8 Mud Rehab area in my area for letting the politicals do this kind of thing. So in that environment, Jack gets it in his head that he wants to allocate project-based certificates to a project in New York in violation of the procedures we've now installed so that this could never happen on our watch. So one day I'm in a meeting and Delabovi acts really scary. He pulls me aside and he says, I want you to send this many project-based certificates to Abe Biederman of HDC in New York. And I said, Al, are you crazy? What you're asking me to do is exactly what we just stood up in the papers and said was wrong for the Reagan administration to do. We've just announced we've put in a whole bunch of procedures and now you're asking me to do it, but there's something even more important. We're out of project-based certificates for the year, and Al said, just promise them next year's. And I said, Al, that is a violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act. That is illegal. You are ordering me to do something that is illegal. But let me make this more clear to you. I'm going to have to do this. I would have to call up a bunch of career bureaucrats who Keating and you just sat around and criticized for letting the Reagan guys do this. You know, so how long do we think it's going to take them to call the New York Times and the IG hotline and report us for doing it? I mean, forget that it's illegal and forget that it's unethical and forget that we said we would never do it. Let me assure you, we will get caught. We will absolutely get caught. And Al said, just do it anyway. And I said, no, Al, I'm not going to do it. And he said, well, you've got to talk to Jack. So the two of us went in. It was one of the few times Al ever let me in front of Jack. And Jack said, you know, I want you to do it. And Jack seemed scared to death. I said,
I said, Jack, I said, you can't do this. You will get caught. This is too dangerous. You cannot do it. And he just looked at me and said, do it. And I said, Mr. Secretary, I can't do it. One, it's illegal, but two, you're going to get caught. We're all going to get caught. You can't do it. I said, let me see if there is another way, but I have to tell you, we can't do it. So I left the office and I thought, what in the world is going on? Well, I had to go to Chicago shortly thereafter. I called in and phoned out from Jim Logue, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Multifamily.
So I call in and I talk to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Multifamily, Jim Logue. And what Jim Logue tells me is that while I've been out, Della Bovey has gotten my General Deputy, Peter Monroe, and Jim Logue, and Larry Goldberger, who runs the Mod Rehab area. He's arranged for them to send the certificates. And he's pulled them into his office and called Abe Bitterman up at HDC. And said to him in Italian, it's done. In front of all of them. So I called Keating, who was the general counsel, and I said, Frank, what Al just did is illegal. It's against the law. And he just did it in a way that a lot of people are going to find out about that. Now, you are the general counsel, and I understand that you don't care about the law, but I understand you do care about politics. So what I'm going to tell you is, this has got to, you have got to unwind this now, because this is very dangerous. So Frank hung up and went in and worked on Jack and Della Bovey and got it unwound. What I found out subsequent to that was that the certificates promised were for one of Andrew Cuomo's, I think Andrew Cuomo's first homeless project in New York. Now, sort of the trading partner politics around D'Amato and Mary Cuomo and Andrew Cuomo and Jack were always very intimate and interesting. But what was amazing about the whole story was how afraid Jack was. He was scared to death. And he didn't care what kind of press or problems we had getting those project-based certificates to Andrew. He was scared to death. I will never forget his face. Now, I have no idea what that means. But it said to me that the relationships between Jack D'Amato and the Cuomos were, I just figured those guys had an exponential amount of dirty pictures on each other. But that was my first sort of Kemp and Cuomo.